Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Wait, what? Supreme. Wait, stop. Stop the theme. Keep it going. Stop the theme. Wait, you said that if you sit next to Seth Rogen, you're going to be rich like him?
On the 1st of January? Yes. If I start the year sitting next to Seth
That's
Rogen?
That's the myth, yeah.
Shit. I'm going to be rich and funny.
Okay. Here we go.
All right.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Now Questlove here thinking,
yeah,
which is which?
Yeah.
Maybe I need to switch my seat,
yeah,
so I too can get rich.
Roll call. Suprema.
I'm just saying.
Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a mess.
Yeah.
Been smoking way too much.
Yeah.
Pineapple Express.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
This is Boss Bill.
Yeah.
Back again, my friends.
Yeah.
This is the third line.
Yeah.
And this is the end.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
It's La Ia.
Yeah.
With Seth, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
But this will be better than fucking a horse.
Roll call.
Suprema.
You went to a dark place.
Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Seth.
Yeah.
I'm feeling old.
Yeah.
And in New York.
Yeah.
I'm fucking cold.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Suprema.
Suprema roll call.
Suprema.
Suprema
roll call.
They're excited too.
This is how we're going to start.
this is how we're going to start off
the new year 2020.
This is a bad omen.
All right. Well, that's cool. The gods saw to it that we should have no more theme.
Get to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the newly rich, nouveau riche, Questlove. Another episode. Happy New Year. This is January 1st, 2020. Everybody, how do you feel?
Good.
Old and cold.
Yeah. Old and cold. Yeah.
Old and cold.
How was your holiday? Your festivities?
It was...
Old and cold?
No, we had a great time, of course.
Okay.
So great, we can't remember.
Did the checks come through?
Yeah, the Hanukkah checks cleared, so...
Cool.
I'm
actually shocked because whenever... any of your brethren come on the show, your roll call is usually geared towards.
You do Jewy roll calls?
Yeah.
I thought about incorporating the Jewy part, but I just left it with the stoner part.
It was a stoner first.
I think, yeah, I was about to say,
Stonerness and Jewiness are pretty, like, there's a lot of overlap.
Unpaid Bill would not approve. Anyway, I'm your host, Questlove, joined today by my croonies, Laia, Boss Bill, Sugar Steve. Unpaid Bill surprisingly isn't here.
Yeah.
He was going to be here.
Wait, is he not coming or is he?
Did we
call him? Did we let him know?
We let him know. You know, he does plays, Sesame Streets and stuff. So
oh, okay. He's chilling with some Muppets.
Enough bagel jokes we can make without him.
Anyway, not to stall anymore, ladies and gentlemen, we have comedian, director, producer, actor, writer, leading man, cannabis connoisseur.
Yeah.
Advocate for sleeping in the bedroom under 67 degrees.
Yes,
it's true.
Yes.
We'll get into that. We're going to discuss that later. I guess Philadelphia music culture fan, Boyz II Men and the Roots, ladies and gentlemen, and hip hop head and Canadian, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Seth Rogen.
Yay!
Yes. We made it.
Thank you.
This is a show of rabbit holing.
Yes,
so let's just start at the beginning. All right, I'm miffed. All right, so I have to explain that.
A lot of backstory.
I was very fortunate to attend Seth's Hilarity for Charity event. Shout out to Manish and Mary Ellis of Museum of Ice Cream.
Alzheimer's event.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I went there, and the discussion of how much sleep does a person need to
have a healthy brain.
Yeah, have a healthy brain,
health.
Brain and all
the
those
theme
things.
Was brain health.
Yes.
Yes.
No, I learned a lot. Yeah. I learned that as of lately, I'll say in the last 2 months, I've been back into the 8 hour range of sleeping.
That's good.
Because I killed for that.
Right, because people were always like, when do you sleep? When do you sleep?
And I was
like,
because you didn't used to sleep. You
right.
You would just sit in a chair
for
hours.
I was 3 to 5 hour guy. Mm-hmm. And I was told that you don't even reach REM state until 6 hours and 47 minutes. And for your body to heal, and, you know, I'm adjusting my lifestyle right now. I'm trying to get back to a healthier place. I got to do somewhere between 8 to 10 hours for the magic to begin.
Yeah.
So, but then you guys left me with this gem of the room has to be cold.
Yeah, you sleep best if the room is freezing cold.
I've heard that before.
Like
I've
60 before. In the 60s.
Well, yeah, my girlfriend took that to heart, and now every night.
Yeah, it's cold as hell.
It's been 65 degrees in the bedroom.
Are you sleeping better?
No.
Then you need another blanket.
I'm sleeping well, but it's not. Like, I needed to be Africa hot.
My wife likes it much colder than me, and that's why they have heating pads. That's what we were talking about. There's pads for mattresses where you can set the temperature so you can keep your side hot and her side cold. And it's something that throughout.
It's like McDLT?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, deep cut.
Perfect.
That is a deep cut.
I'm sorry.
It's exactly right. But no, it's fun. And I think as men get older, they get colder, and as women get older,
they get
hotter.
On fire.
Yeah.
They're
hotter.
To say.
Yeah. Me and my wife have kind of, we were just talking about how we like crossed over. Like when we first started dating, I was always hot and she was always cold. And now I'm always cold and she's always hot. And we probably had like 3 years where we were both the same temperature and we didn't realize how good that time was until it was gone.
No, it could be really problematic.
Yeah.
Because I'll get up, I'll reach my limit at exactly like 4:17 a.m. And
you're freezing. Are you shivering?
I'll sneak up. Wait, here's another.
Don't you tell her. Don't you put your hand on that thermostat.
Do you remember?
Do it.
All right. You remember on Sesame Street, the green guy in the trench coat that used to always sell Ernie like a letter?
Hey, bud.
Yeah.
Who, me?
Yeah. He was that the guy. Illicit letter dealer.
Right. Him. So like his little creep music.
The creeping tiptoe music.
Yes, exactly. So I'm in my own house that I pay for. Creeping. Putting that shit back to like something normal, like 68, 69.
Yeah, I don't go below 68. That's where we've landed. My wife, Lauren, would go to this like low 60s. If
over
she
35,
had her, like,
you got to go to 66, bruh.
That's
for
crazy.
A woman. You got to.
That's,
why? Just put on another blanket and then make it hot underneath it. You know what I'm saying? That's the goal. Think about it.
What's the logic behind keeping it colder? What's the physics of your body?
I mean, the thing is that your brain is divided into two parts. There's the conscious brain, and the conscious brain is like, hey, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to go to work later today. I'm going to take the subway home. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to ask that girl out. And then it's the subconscious, which does stuff like, I'm going to make sure your heart's beating.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure your waist. So it's the part of your brain.
The medulla oblongata?
Whoa.
Yeah. Inagata Devita. What do you say? And so.
It's actually a fish song.
Of course. And so your body has to be totally knocked out. So you get to that REM state at exactly 6 hours and 45 minutes. When you're that sleep, then your right side of the brain's like waking up like, all right. He's asleep. Let's get to work. Aww. And so then that's where the fat burns. That's where, like, all the things that you want to help have happen for your life to be good, your brain's like, all right, they're knocked out now. Now we can get to work. But the thing is that most of us don't get that much sleep. So
no, it's fucked up.
We're doing ourselves a disservice by only sleeping 6 to 7 hours.
It's terrible for you.
But yeah.
You didn't answer my question. Why does it have to be cold?
Probably because it was cold at night.
You
mean like before we had houses?
Yeah, like it's probably like we're conditioned to sleep in colder environments.
So that's So listen.
I know
so here's
I
the
am.
Thing. So so at this event, okay, can we just agree that this entire hour is going to be about this?
No.
I'm kind of on your side of the fence. Why does it have to be so damn cold?
No, I mean, I'm just asking.
No. I'm asking. I'm.
What's the scientific part of
I don't think
how
he can
coldness
answer.
Helps?
I don't know.
That's what I want to know.
Google
That's
it.
Where we change the subject because y'all ain't professionals.
We don't know.
I'm just going to suggest everybody hop on Google.
Yeah.
Com.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Type
why
it
do,
in.
Why
and then
do
we
sleep
can continue with the episode.
Cold.
Anyway,
yeah.
Let's talk about movies.
Where are you born?
But you do sleep better when it's cold.
And that's a fact. So,
we don't need whys. Are we giving whys? We're just giving answers here.
Exactly. It's been said that.
Completely unsubstantiated information.
No, scientists have gone on record and said
no,
so.
We had a doctor. He substantiated it.
Yeah.
I kind of believe you.
Me and my curiosity. I don't know.
Exactly. Don't ask why, man.
So you were born in
Vancouver,
British Columbia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Home of the hip-hop national anthem. Wait, who else was...
Sophia Chang. I was going to ask
Sophia
him if he
Chang.
Knew Sophia
oh,
Chang, because
right,
he's a Wu-Tang head.
Yeah,
but that
Sophia,
episode hasn't aired
manager?
Yet. So.
Yeah, you know Sophia?
I think I've met her over the years, actually. Yeah, you know,
she's like a badass yeah. Korean chick.
She'll be on the future episode.
That's
of
great.
Wallace. Anyway,
No, the Rascals are a hip hop group from Vancouver that were
The Rascals.
They were called like
Northern Touch.
Yeah, Rascals, Checkmate, Cardinal, and Thrust.
Did you say Cardinal
and Chuck Clare?
How do you know this?
How do you know that? Very no American knows that song.
I do my research before
that
I come
is very
in this room.
Good. Well, maybe you can help.
I felt
did
like
DMX
you knew it
straight
naturally.
Up steal the beat of that song for a song.
I think he may have.
Yeah, yeah. There is a DMX song with the exact same beat as Northern Touch. And I think if you're Canadian, it's very jarring. But if you're not,
like,
then you're like, oh, this is a good beat.
Oh, they
that,
stole
darn it. Darn it. I can't. Yeah.
Oh, I know what you did.
Yeah,
BT Express, the BT Express sample that EPMD used.
Yeah, for Headbanger.
Well, no. For, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Was Northern Touch first?
Get the Bozak. No, EPMD was first. And
then Northern Touch.
Yes.
Maybe.
And then DMX came and just took it.
Wow. Third generation sample.
Did you know that your hometown is also what I consider the national anthem of hip hop? Did you know that Apache was created in Vancouver?
Apache?
Yes, Apache was recorded and created in Vancouver.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's one of my favorite factoids about.
That is a very good factoid.
Vancouver.
And the other and Nardwar's from Vancouver is the other.
I
one.
Love
yeah,
Nardwar.
Yeah, your interviews with him are great.
Have you interviewed Nardwar?
I've been interviewed by him once.
Have
yeah.
you ever seen a non-savory Nardwar interview? Like a lot of the earlier ones where they don't
oh, yes.
know if he's trolling them or not.
Oh yes. So I mean, I grew up watching him, so I've seen like so many.
Wait, you grew? How long has he been doing this?
Like 30 years.
Wait, how old is
Nardwar? He's like 50-something.
Nardwar is 50-something?
Yes.
I thought he was younger than me.
No. There's actually an amazing Nardwar interview with Nirvana, like backstage at the PNE Forum, which is the like place in Vancouver from like 1993 or something. And like Courtney Love is there. And it's like a very long interview that's filmed. And throughout, it's like 40 minutes or something. Like throughout the course of it, you see Kurt Cobain like slowly realize he's a genius. And like at first, it's this thing where it's just like, why is this fucking guy here bothering me? And then he slowly like clues into how
that's
amazing
how he
it
gets
is.
You.
Yeah, he totally does. No, but I've seen because now people know who he is. Like,
right.
But for years I would watch interviews where famous musicians would just get interviewed by him and be like, "Who the fuck is this guy?" And even still, some people don't. I
get
feel
it.
Like don't get it. I feel like who,
people. Yeah. All right, so. That Jay-Z interview.
The Jay-Z didn't seem to appreciate Nardwar.
No, I warned him about it. Yeah. I begged him to do it. And then Pharrell doubled down.
Yeah.
So he did it because if we say it's a thing,
yeah.
then Jay-Z's just one of them FOMO. I don't want to miss out.
Yeah, he's got to
do it. He don't know Questlove Supreme is
a thing. You're, well, you know.
Yeah, well.
Anyway.
2020.
And so, but I'll say that the first time he interviewed me, I was paranoid because he just knew way.
Oh, it's weird.
Too much information.
Yes, he knew shit about me that was.
He brought out your high school
shocking.
Yearbooks.
Yeah, he had my high school yearbooks. Literally, he like knew people. He knew names that I hadn't heard in like 25 years.
He brought a bag from the shop that your mom used to work.
Yes,
at?
Literally. That it's totally crazy.
It would freak me out.
It was super fucking freaky. But his knowledge is. Bizarre. He's always trying to get to Kanye. He's like, that's his holy grail. He like emails me and texts me all the time.
Oh, you too?
Always.
I'm not alone?
Not at all. Yes.
I can see that going very bad.
He somehow thinks that I have the magic touch to get him to the Obamas.
Wow. I would. That's a compliment.
I was like, I'm so honored.
He's coming to me for Kanye. So that's a big step in a much better direction.
I read somewhere, somebody said online that... that when you get to the pearly gates of heaven, it's Nardwar. He's the one that's reviewing your entire
Hello
life.
There.
So speaking of your hometown, are you? Is every time I ask anybody from Vancouver, are you knowledgeable of the La Casa gelato, or is that just for tourist suckers like me? It's the place that has...
They didn't pay for
like
that pluck.
Like hundreds of flavors of gelato. Yes. Yeah, it's near... it's on like the north end of kind of the east side of Vancouver or
it's
something like
It's my favorite
that.
Place ever. I might...
It's not somewhere I grew up going, but it's somewhere that I've heard of it.
So again, it's made for tourist suckers?
I think it might be kind of a tourist.
You never tried like balsamic vinegar ice cream?
Yeah, that's right. I've heard. Yeah, it was one of the first places to start doing like weird flavors of shit like that.
Yeah, they have cheddar cheese.
It's like Jenny's. Yeah. No. Basically Jenny's. No.
Cheddar cheese ice cream, man.
They had like a tobacco one or something like that, I think, for a while. Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of the weird ones I liked. Like they had black pepper vanilla.
That's weird. How is cheddar cheese? I bet that's good.
Well, that's the thing. You basically, you sample all the weird ones, and then you get the rocky road that you came in for.
That's a purely, North American thing, is sampling ice cream. Like,
it's considered rude?
Well, I was in Italy, and not to brag, but I was in Italy in a gelato shop, and there was, a rush of Americans left, and me and my wife were the only people in the restaurant, and the woman behind the counter, very quietly looked at us and goes, "Can I ask you a question?" We're like, "Yeah." She goes, "How come American always ask to taste everything?"
Wow.
And she's like, "What is this? Like, nowhere else you ask to taste everything." And I was like, "You're right. When you put it like that, it is pretty fucking weird. Like, nowhere else you'd be like, 'Can I try that sandwich? Can I have a piece of that?'"
Baskin and Robbins.
That's what I said. I said, I think it all roots back to this one place, Baskin Robbins, where they encourage people to do it, and that ruined ice cream all over the fucking
Are they still a thing?
Yeah.
Because I know that the sun.
You are so cute.
What?
You said, are they still a thing? I'm like, they combine with Dunkin' Donuts.
No.
Yeah, they're in like Subways.
But that's the thing, though.
Are they
I know that the sun inherited the empire. And because, generations are the opposites of what their parents were.
Right.
The sun wasn't he didn't. He was concerned about the cows they were using, and wanted free range. And so instead, he took the family money and did this expose on how ice cream companies are ruining cows the environment and all this thing.
It's like ice cream Succession.
So they, exactly.
Not Ben and Jerry.
That's crazy.
So, no, not Ben and Jerry. Baskin and Robbins.
I know, I was just saying the ice cream industry.
Which probably explains why they had to partner with
Dunkin' Donuts.
KFC.
Dunkin' Donuts.
KFC, Baskin Robbins, or whatever.
But that margarita flavor still there is good.
They have margarita ice cream?
They have a margarita flavor. They've had it forever.
Wow.
Good to condition children at a young age to develop a taste for margaritas.
So 20 minutes. So 20 minutes into this interview. Let's start. Seth. So you being born in the early 80s in Vancouver, what was your environment like in your household?
My household, I lived on the east side of Vancouver, which in a 100% East Indian neighborhood.
Okay.
So it was great. It was I would walk around a lot. I was just arguing with my parents. Their memory was that I never walked around alone, and I definitively did all the time. And would take the bus all around the city. But I went to school on the west side. I grew up, I started doing stand-up when I was young, 12 or 13, and I would started writing around then too, and I'd smoked weed a lot. And so much has changed in my life since I was 12. I hate to.
So jealous.
So the myth of Superbad and you crafting this at such a young age is
100%
actual
true.
Factual?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, me and my partner Evan, who I still work with, met in bar mitzvah class when we were 12, and then started writing together not long after that. And we had, yeah, we probably finished a draft of Superbad when we were like 14 or 15. Wow. For
you
the
did
first
a complete
time.
Draft?
Yeah, by then. Yeah, but we started when we were like 13. And there is some, and it's like, it's one of those things where it's almost sad that like I'm not that much smarter or funnier than I was when I was 13 years old. Because there are some jokes in the movie that like we wrote when we were 13 that are still in the movie, or that are in the movie that like, that held up and that are still, yeah, you'd like to think you got better in that amount of time.
So at 14, your script looked like a professional. I'm trying to
yeah,
figure
I
out how you guys
I made,
knew.
I yeah. asked my mom to buy me Final Draft, which was the script writing software, and she did. My parents were like super supportive because I also did stand-up, so they saw that like I would work hard, you know what I mean?
So this is 96.
Yeah, this is probably 95 or 96 or something like that. Yeah, 95, I would say, 96, yeah.
Like, all right, I'm curious, and this leads back to the conscious, subconscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When your subconscious is convinced of something,
yeah,
then your body does it, which explains why, you know, Kanye uses outward affirmations. I am the greatest.
Yes.
I am the greatest. And then everything happens for him, the same way with Trump. Yeah. Same way with Diddy, the same way with Jay.
Remember they remixed it and called it a secret?
I have $6 million in my bank account right now. I have $6 million in my bank account right now. I have $6 million in my bank account right now. I have $6 million in my bank account right now. Right now.
So I'm curious what inside you gave you the balls to even be like, yo, let's write a movie now. Like it didn't even start with like, let's start with community theater or hey, how do you do this? Or did you see a movie one day and it's like, I could do better than this?
Literally,
shit.
That's what happened. Like,
what movie did you see that set you off?
I can't remember. And we argue
you saw Pulp
over
Fiction,
it all
didn't
the,
you?
We love no. Pulp Fiction. And that was like, no, like that was something. I had a Pulp Fiction poster on my bedroom door, like throughout.
If you were a teenager in the 90s, you had a Pulp Fiction poster.
Yeah, I mean, that came out in 94, maybe. I was 12, so we saw it around then. And it was also the era of like independent, it was like the resurgence of this independent film. Like, Clerks came out around then.
And
Rushmore and Wes Anderson and Bottle Rocket. So there was.
You saw all those films?
Oh, yeah. We were obsessed with them. And it's also one of those things that was – my parents loved movies, and they were just huge movie fans, so they would, like, watch a lot of movies and collect movies. Vancouver, they made some stuff there. So it's not like Hollywood, but, like, you would see – movie sets around. And so there was like, it wasn't this like completely unobtainable thing. And then in high school, our high school was right across the street from two video store, like giant video stores. And we would rent movies. Like we watched, all we would do is like smoke weed and watch movies basically. And when you watch enough movies, you start to think maybe we could do this. And if we write something that's like cheap, then maybe that was always the thought was like, it was set in high school super bad and we were like, worst comes to worst, like this becomes something we like, we made movies with like our, like, you know, we had a video camera, we were like, we could technically make this ourselves if we wanted to, you know.
What was your North Star in terms of okay, so now it's just hitting me that because I had family that worked at an independent movie theater back in 91-92, so I always had free tickets. But, you know, we're seeing El Mirachi, we're seeing, like, all these indie films, which, I mean, at the time I didn't realize it, but it was grooming me to gear towards art house stuff opposed to mainstream stuff. But for you, what were your... were you a film snob or were you just like, yo, I got Porgies and Hot Dog?
Yeah. No, we
remember
like
Hot Dog, the ski movie?
Yeah, of course. I saw Hot Dog. I liked all those
Shannon
ski movies.
Do you remember Hamburger, the motion picture?
Yeah, Hamburger.
Hamburger.
Put those cookies back, motherfucker.
Was there a Hamburger movie?
Yes. Yes.
I got to see it.
Oh, it was amazing.
On Shout TV, there's a specific, like, C movie
yeah.
VHS yeah. section.
Anything oh. that was on HBO late night in like we the, yeah. the mid-80s.
Oh, yeah. We would just rent movies based on what the cover of the box looked
the
like.
The Garbage 100%. Pail Kids. If anybody can find the Garbage Pail Kids.
Well, it's
Kids
funny,
movie.
This Dolemite movie just came out. I haven't watched yeah. it yet, but awesome. we were obsessed with Dolemite because like it was one of those movies that like purely based on the cover.
On the cover.
We were like, what is this?
We did the same thing. Like every Friday night, we would all meet up at this Mexican restaurant in town,
yeah.
and then we would all like caravan over to the video store, argue for about a half an hour about what video we're going to pick out.
Yeah.
Oh, and we would argue for hours. Yeah, We'd spend more time in the video store than we would watching the movies we rented at the video. Like, that was the activity, was going to the video store and deciding to argue over a movie.
What we did, we called it Tasteless Movie Night. We would try to find the most tasteless movie we could find in the video store.
Perfect.
Yeah, and we would just go to my friend Darren's basement and watch it, and just, like, it was commentary.
It was perfect.
Commentary. Yeah. No weed involved. I'm sure if there had been, well, his mom was a teacher, so that would never happen.
So what were your go-to films?
Well, I think it's like one thing I look at is like the movies. It's obviously something I've thought about, you know, is like the movies my parents owned. Like they owned like 40 movies on like VHS that they would like, there was like three movies to a VHS. They would like tape them off TV when they came on. And like,
would you ever watch them?
I did all the time.
Oh, you
and
did?
And
I
those
did, yeah.
movies are like cemented in my brain. I know every word to every one
all
of them.
Me.
And I also bet that if I like made a list of all those movies, they like directly correlate to the movies that I've made since then, basically.
Come
like
on, Steph. One.
Well, it's like Ghostbusters and movies like that. My dad loved Bill Murray. They also loved like Woody Allen and like independent, like they had like Hannah and Her Sisters and like Annie Hall and movies like that. And I would watch those movies a lot. And then they had like Albert Brooks movies, and my dad loved Billy Crystal. And so like it was a lot of that stuff. And my mom though loved action movies. And so we had like Die Hard and Total Recall and like Under Siege, I remember we had like right when it came out. And Lethal Weapon was like one of my mom's favorite movies. Yeah. And so I would watch these like emotionally driven kind of comedy drama movies and like the most violent, insane action movies. And that's kind of
this
a lot
the
of
end.
The stuff we make now.
I see.
Yeah. And so all those movies, like we loved. And then when Pulp Fiction and those movies started to come out, we became obsessed. And Reservoir Dogs, we loved. And like, and then we got really into Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson's early movies, like Army of Darkness. We watched over and over and over again, and Dead Alive. We watched a lot, and like, and then to see those guys go on, that was another thing. Is like you'd see like, oh, like Sam Raimi's directing Spider-Man, and like these guys who like we were already fans of for making like the weirdest shit ever
now doing
were then crossing over and becoming really successful, and I think making big things, and that was also I think something we always liked and that was interesting to us. But we just like devoured movies.
Did Vancouver have much of a social or nightlife? Because I'm thinking that Vancouver is almost like, all right, what Minneapolis was to Prince.
Yeah.
And how there was a scene there, but because there's not much to do.
Yes.
He had a lot of time to hone his craft and just do music.
A lot, yes. Vancouver.
And the weather also determines your staying in.
Vancouver's a city where people sit, like, go to someone's house and smoke weed. That's like the activity.
Wow. Clearly, that was your experience.
No, that
doesn't mean that.
No, that is like what people do there. And when it's nice out, you go to a nature place and smoke weed. It's like a very like weed was like super prevalent, and like it's a huge. It's like one of the most progressive cities in the world when it comes to weed.
Even
and,
in your childhood, the 90s,
100%.
So you've never been arrested for.
Right when I moved to LA, I got arrested because I didn't understand how much more strict it was than it was in Vancouver. Like all throughout high school, if we got caught with weed, the cops would just take it. No, they wouldn't even always take it. They would just be like, go away. Like it was such low on prior, like on the priorities because Vancouver had like a terrible heroin problem. And it was like had a really rough drug problem. And so weed very early on became deprioritized and decriminalized. And from when I was a kid, there was a coffee shop you could go smoke weed in. And there was like indoor, like places you go inside and smoke weed. And
so
let you.
Seth, you never known weed with seeds, huh?
I have. But yeah, when I first moved to LA, we'd buy pounds of Mexican weed.
Okay.
Wait, virgin here. What does that mean?
It means lots of seeds in your weed.
Yeah, and these days it's Reggie. So yeah. We call it Reggie, regular weed. But to me, if Vancouver's been in the hierarchy of the weed game, I would just assume that, like,
had good, like, hydroponic weed.
You don't want to smoke the seeds because
that's the sterile part, too. Yeah. Sterile.
Wait. I don't know if that's true.
Time out.
I don't know if there's science behind
that. Steve, where are you?
Wait. That's what I'm saying. Why is it taking 3 years for me to how are you just going to let Laia come here and drink your milkshake?
Right. All of our parents smoke weed with seeds in them, and we stole them. We had to pick them out, remember? And it pops and it burns the seeds. It burns the seeds, this leather. Yeah. So you got to be careful.
It's true. It falls out of the joint sometimes.
My dad's a culprit all the time. Like, God damn, Daddy, you're always smoking in your car. Look at them hoes.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, Daddy.
I did not know that.
Can we go mad?
Stop snitching, D.
You started stand-up at a young age.
Yeah.
14?
Yeah, 13 or 14.
Okay,
like
so the only person I know that had that experience was Chappelle.
Yeah.
How?
I think Eddie Murphy started around that age also.
Yeah, so how
They're
do you,
much better than
How do you... how do you even negotiate your way into...
A club?
Yeah.
My mom helped. She would talk to... She drove me to every show, literally, because I couldn't drive. Yeah, and what's funny is very early on, it's one of those like happy coincidences. I did a fundraiser when I was like 14, a small one, that the premier, who's like the governor kind of British Columbia, was at. And my mother cornered him and was like, if my son's performing at a bar, can he be in the bar? And the guy was like, legally, yes. And she got his office to send a letter saying that as long as I was performing, it is legal for me to be in the premises. And I would have to leave right after. So like, I would sit backstage and I would show it to the club. There was only like four clubs anyway, but once they had all seen it, they would let me perform there. And then I performed like regularly, and I was like pretty good. Like, I wasn't...
What was the check like at that age? Did you get a check?
Every once in a while I would like open for a comic and I'd get like $150 or something like that, which when you're fucking...
But did you use your...
Like, fantastic.
Did you use your kiddom? Did you use your youth?
I tried not to. At first I didn't at all. Because I was so self-conscious about being, like, gimmicky that I would try to tell jokes.
You're 14. Who thinks like a neurotic adult?
Yes, I was very neurotic. And I didn't want to be, like, the kid comic. So I tried to write jokes that any comic would write that were, like, more like observational humor. But it was...
Were you blue?
I wasn't.
I always wanted
first.
To ask a comic.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you a blue comic?
You work blue. I didn't actually at first at all, also. But then I remember this comic, Daryl Lennox, who still does stand up and he's great. He was like, I was telling all the comics would make fun of me because I had a joke about like crazy glue. What's so crazy about it? And it was like the dumbest like observational humor of all time. And then Daryl, I remember, like, sat me down and I was like 15 and he was like, dude, like, you are the only one of us who's like experiencing all these things like in real time. Like, you're trying to kiss girls for the first time. You're trying to get your driver's license. You're trying to buy beer. You're trying to go to parties. You're trying to sneak into strip clubs, like, write jokes about that. Like, that's something that, like, right, everyone's gone through in some way, and you're living it, like, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay. And then that was also one of the things that really influenced Superbad, where at first it was more like, let's write a high school movie. And then we were like, no, let's write, like, whenever something happens to us, let's put it in the movie and let's make us the characters in the movie, and let's like structure it around
so
that.
So those things happen to you guys in Superbad?
Not all in one night, but almost all. A lot of the stuff in the movie happened. Wow. Yeah, like in some form or another. Like, and every
so you grinded up against a girl. And
that happened at a school dance. Yeah, that actually. And in real life, I was one of the guys. Like, it played out almost verbatim as it did in the movie, except one of our friends was the Joda character in real life, and I was one of the guys who was like, what is that? Like, what's on your leg there? And that's what happened, and so it was a school dance, and we all put our stuff in like the locker room, in like the gym locker room, like before, and we were getting it after the dance. And Yeah, and like one of our friends was like, "Did you spill on yourself?" And we were there, like looking at it, and then what happened? And we kind of allude to this in the movie is we noticed on the other side of the locker room there was another group of guys having the exact same conversation, and they were all like looking at their friend's leg, poking at it, being like, "What is that? Did you spill? Did someone cut themselves?" And then like two groups like locked eyes from across the room, and it was like this Kaiser Soze moment where it was like, "Oh no, I think." We have a situation on our hands. And then there was a lot of like cross-referencing who they had danced with. Right. And
wait, I got a preface for the two people who haven't seen Superbad. Yes. There's a crucial scene where there's a dance, sort of grindy dance moment in which a girl rubs her crotch on Jonah Hill's.
I think it's pronounced cooch.
Yeah,
cooch. Oh, crotch. I forgot.
No, the cooch is inside the crotch. Maybe
it's inside.
Yeah. Anyway, and, unbeknownst to Jonah Hill, his thighs or his jeans are now maroon 5.
Yes,
I'll just say that
much. They got period blood.
They're bloody.
They're period blood.
That's
it happened.
Oh wait, you're just getting that now?
I just remember. I couldn't remember if he had came on himself or if it was period. So now.
Also on the table.
Yeah. The way y'all was talking about it,
no, that was in Long Shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Dang.
You know, also a joke.
You know, my favorite thing about I visit a lot of local comedy houses in New York.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is actually watching people bomb or fail. No. Only because, like, now I'm entering a stage in my life where I'm going to have to give a lot more public addressing.
Yeah.
And it's always how you handle yourself in that moment.
Yeah.
That separates the men from the boys. Yeah. And so a lot of times, like, if you go to, like, I love going to the store in L.A. when it's the 1 a.m. show, the very last show. And usually, like, the last three people are always, like, the doorman, the bell guy, like, okay, I'll let you go up and do 5 minutes. Like, everyone's left the room.
Yeah. I've performed there at that time when I was, like, 16 years old.
Right. Because I feel in my mind that whenever I'm watching them, then I believe at one point either, not Gerard Carmichael, who's the guy that I liked? America's
Jamar Neighbors.
Jamar Neighbors. Yeah, Jamar Neighbors was one of those guys, and he's hilarious. Yeah. Like, he's one of Gerard Carmichael's dudes. But, like, it's always the last three people on the graveyard shift that I love watching them the most to see how they adjust to it.
Yeah.
Have you, when you were in sort of developing your skills or whatnot, have you ever had to resort to what they would call the, what's the syndrome? Like aristocrat syndrome, or when you know that you've done a bad set and you're just performing for your buds, like, okay, I fucked up. And
always.
Did everyone do the aristocrats, or was it another thing where?
I never did that specifically, but there was, I mean, yeah, shit would go bad. And there would, and there would be times, where you would just kind of throw it all out, and it was like, I think managing the audience's discomfort is something that is a lesson that I learned at a young age, and that, like, you can carry with you across many different avenues of life.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that is very valuable. And I did it. Yeah, I remember doing, but my friends could never come watch me, though, because I was a kid and they weren't allowed into the club. It was always strangers. But I had times when just group tables full of adults would get up and leave. It was terrible. I remember performing at the improv. I remember coming to L.A. to audition for the Just for Last Festival when I was like 15 and going to the improv. And Jerry Seinfeld decided to drop in at the Just for Laughs stand-up comedy showcase, went on right before me, fucking annihilated. Left.
Do you guys hate when that happened? Like when the big star comes in and is like, "Hey, I want to practice 30
for a
minutes
comedy show." Yes, on a fucking showcase.
Did you ever get to tell Jerry what he did to you?
Yes, he could not have been more indifferent. And then I went up after him, and I literally, like, to this day remember standing on the stage and and it being so quiet, I could hear the electric hum of the speakers. Like, I could, and I had never, and I'd been doing stand-up for years at that point, and I had never heard that sound. I remember, like, thinking to myself, like, wow, like, have the speakers always been making that sound, and I just haven't heard it, or do these ones have, like, a particularly loud hum to them? But I just remember hearing, like, I was like, oh, that's a new one. Yeah, it was brutal.
So at the time...
I didn't get into the Just for Last Festival.
Oh, dang.
So, Jerry.
Yes.
Could you explain how you got inside of the, I guess, the mafia of the, what I call the Apatow...
The Apatow Mafia.
The Apatow Mafia.
Yeah, I mean, it was all... I was doing stand-up, and I got an agent through stand-up, and I was like... 16 or 17, and so high school was, like, gonna end, and I, like, was not gonna go to college, so I was like, I need money, so I should start trying to audition for things, and my, like, plan, if you ask me at that point what my plan was, I'll be like, oh, I'll move to L.A. after high school, and I'll try to do stand-up, and...
So you wanted to be a straight-up stand-up comic.
Yeah, and then I thought maybe I'll get, like, on, like, a sitcom. That was kind of, like, the only precedent of that. In that time, that was, like, the thing... that seemed the most achievable because it was like Seinfeld was on Martin. And like Everybody Loves Raymond and Martin like that. Like at the time, it seemed like if you were a successful stand up, you got a sitcom. And I always liked movies more. And so that was always something that I like wanted, but it wasn't as like it seemed like the types of movies I wanted to make at that time, especially were like very small independent movies. And at that time, Superbad seemed like it would be like Rushmore. You know what I mean? Like, not in its artfulness, but just in its scope, you know? And I think that then I moved... So I auditioned for Freaks and Geeks. It was the second audition I got out sent out on. And they auditioned kids out of Vancouver. Like, they did international...
Wait, oh, you all were from Vancouver?
No, they did international searching. Oh, okay. They auditioned in New York and Chicago and Boston and Toronto and Vancouver. And I went in for an audition one morning in Vancouver and... And then I got it. And then I moved to L.A. And I worked with the same people.
I watched that show in the first one. Don't let people – I know people now like to revision it like, yo, man, yeah. Freaks and Geeks with my shit, man. You're like, oh, yeah? Well, yeah, if it was, watch? Then yeah. why did we get a second season?
Right. To watch it, yeah.
Well, I watched it because during the time of us recording Do You Want More?
Yeah.
There was always a TV on the break room.
Yeah.
So that's how I remember Freaks and Geeks. That was my favorite. I thought, oh man, this is way better than my so-called life or Wonder Years. Like,
damn, I was just thinking about that as he was talking. That's
some shit I can get with.
Yeah.
Like, were you excited of the critical acclaim it got, and did you?
I had no. Like, I was like a 17-year-old pothead from Vancouver who, like, I had no concept of any of that shit. Like, I remember people being like,
"So you weren't a businessman yet?" And
I just didn't. I think I was so, I was really confident, and I felt like everything, like when someone's like, everyone loves your show, like it has 100% good reviews. I was like, yeah, it's fucking great. Like it wasn't like, really? It was like, of course, we're putting out great shit. Like, there's nothing like this on TV. Like, of course, everyone, like, and if anything, that made it more frustrating that no one was watching it because, like, we knew it was good. And that's something I look back on and think, like, I didn't even think of the quality of the show when I went and did it. Like, it could have been the worst. Like, I was just like, a job? I'll take it. And then I remember getting to L.A. and to shoot the pilot, and it wasn't even until then that I got the full script, like, the day before we started filming. And then I remember reading it and being like, oh, there's, like, jokes about shrooms in here and shit like that. And then we rehearsed for one day, and they were like, what would you say here? And then all of a sudden... We were improvising, and they were letting us add jokes about Hitler and all this stuff, and we were like, this is really different. And then when we started shooting it, we were like, again, like, the director was from the independent film world. Jake Kasdan had just made Zero Effect, which was a movie I was a big fan of, so it was like, oh, yeah, we have, like, these writers and directors who are, like, doing the exact stuff that I liked. So when it turned out great. It was like, again, I was so, I was really like spoiled at that time because I was just like, yeah, you make something, it turns out
so glad you
perfect.
Know.
Like,
so you weren't putting like two and two together, you know. Like, oh, the creator of the Larry Sanders Show has this new empire.
I knew that, but I didn't, I didn't realize, I think, how like I didn't realize, A, how just because you did something good before doesn't mean you'll keep doing things that everyone appreciates. Like, I was a fan of the Larry Sanders Show, a huge fan, and grew up watching it. And but I didn't, like, I think when I took the, when I first got cast in the show, I had no idea Judd had even, I didn't know Judd. I didn't know who Judd was.
Right.
I didn't know Judd worked on the Larry Sanders Show. There was no IMDb at this time. Like, right. There was no way to look up.
Oh, you did that?
Who
oh,
okay. you were working with, even. Yeah. Like, I had no idea. The internet, yeah, there was no, like, or maybe there's IMDb, but I didn't know how to use it. Yeah, there was no, like, organized way of checking any of that shit.
This is like, when, and James Franco didn't even hit the soaps yet, right? Like,
No, it was like, no one had done anything.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was, but then it started airing as we were shooting, and then they just were like, no one's watching this shit. And it was on Saturday night at 8 or some shit like that against Cops. I remember Judd, like, joking, like, if Cops beats us, we're fucked. And then Cops beat us. And he was like, oh, no.
So were like, you gun shy about Undeclared?
No, because again, I was 18.
Or did you feel like, okay, well, we'll do a better version
like, yeah,
of the show?
I was like, oh, this time we'll do like a more commercial version and we kind of work out the kinks. And like, again, it was like the exact same thing happened where it was like very critically acclaimed and then no one watched it. But I was thrilled, honestly. Like, I was a writer and an actor on Undeclared. I was 18 years old. Like, it was, you know, it was like a very exciting thing for me to be doing. So,
How hard is it living hand to mouth in that period? Because I always
were you?
Well, no, I always
were
feel
you?
Like
because he never had a. Did you ever have a regular job or anything?
Well, no. I after Undeclared, I didn't work for like 3 or 4 years. Basically,
what did you do?
I fucking spent very little money.
But you still never had to work at Pizza Hut or be a server. No,
I would help. Judd was very nice, and he would get these super high-priced rewriting jobs, and then he would give me a little
share
money to help him do it. So, like, I helped rewrite Bad Boys 2 as an example.
Whoa, time out. Wait, time out. First of all, Judd Apatow.
Yes.
So it's like a secret thing.
We wrote that joke that was in the trailer where they're singing the song, and they forget the word. They, like, don't know the words.
Bad,
and
like, what Muhammad, you gonna do? Man.
Yeah. And it was like, yeah, we that was one of the many things we did.
So maintenance, like, work.
Yeah, maintenance work.
Ooh,
yeah.
So what else did you do?
Wait,
little things here and there, like one of the Big Mama's House movies I helped on for a few days, I think.
Wait, so stop. In this moment, because I was fighting saying this because I know my whole family going to get mad at me. But in this moment, are you understanding your white funny man privilege? Because you know that you are like, this is seriously, this is a serious question. Yeah. Like, nobody else, if you hear the struggles of other comedians and things of other colors, women, there is never a moment where they haven't had to, like, serve or do something that they didn't want to do. But it seems like since you were 14 years old, you was on it. You needed Final Draft. You had it. You needed the camera. You had it. At any moment, did you realize this?
I was super, yes. Okay. I was never felt particularly downtrodden. I was very, I felt lucky. I was very, right. I always felt lucky and was very fortunate and like, and got that. Yeah, I mean, there was a time when I was maybe going to, like, but there was a moment where I was like, I might have to move back to Vancouver because I was just running out of money and couldn't afford to live in LA anymore. And that's when I got hired on the Ali G Show. And that, like, continued, that, like,
shut it down.
Yeah, it was, like, it was, like, a great job to have because, like, it sounded great in a room. Like,
right.
It was like when we went on meetings and we were like, oh, we got nominated
HBO,
for,
right?
Yeah, okay. we got nominated for Emmys. That was great. Like, it was something that, like, basically, I haven't stopped working since that. It was like, that was like the thing that kind of kept me going.
Because his brand of comedy, Sacha Baron Cohen, because he's such a rogue, kind of artsy comedian, how do you find his voice? Like, how do you...
It was like...
And the type of stuff he does is more trolling?
It was kind of... it was hard. And I think he liked... And I think it was good that we were so young and malleable at this time when we were working for him. Like, we were like 22 or something like that. And so like he could really, I think without some of like the kid gloves you would use with older people being like, here's what you have to do. Here's what we do. Do exactly fucking this and nothing else.
Wow.
Forget everything you know. Just do this.
So he likes young energy and...
Yeah, and he would literally lock us in a room and be like, write 200 interview questions for me to be interviewing like an environmentalist in a tree. Like, and like, don't come out of that room till you've written me 200 questions.
But
like,
all of his care for both of his, well, he did.
Yeah, we came
characters.
On for Bruno. And then we went on the road with him. We went to spring break. We did all the spring break stuff with Bruno.
What was that like?
It was insane. he almost got killed many times.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, yeah. Like, what happens when you go to
like Daytona Beach? Yeah. It was crazy. What's funny is I had to kind of hide because I was not famous, but I was like one in every 100 people knew me from Freaks and Geeks.
Right.
And so I was kind of had to like, I was like relegated to the hotel room because like he was just like, the chance that someone sees you and puts two and two together is like too great. So like we would travel from city to city and me and Evan would literally just sit in a hotel room in whatever city we were in. And like,
and they, pray they come back alive.
Yeah, exactly. And then they would come back and they would show us the footage of what they had done that day. And we would all just laugh hysterically and be amazed that they hadn't gotten killed. And like, it was fun. Yeah, it was great.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So I have so many questions about your movies, but I'm afraid we'll just get stuck in one of them.
Yeah. No, then...
Pick one.
But
in the end, this is it. I mean, yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's the one.
Well, I mean, there's so many, but I'll say that for, you know, 40-year-old virgin was to me like how much input are you given for scripts, or how open is Judd to having you guys adjust the comedy? Because
really
the way
open.
That it looked, it almost seemed like, oh, this got to be on the spot, and he just said, keep the cameras rolling.
A lot of it was improvised. Yeah, I would say, like, because Superbad had been written, and no one would make it. And same with Pineapple Express.
So you were still shopping it actively?
Yes. And me and Evan, and my especially because Evan was in college at the time and wasn't there all the time, I was always like, people want to see a movie where people talk like this. Like, more than anything, that's what I had a strong feeling of, was like, they want a comedy where people, where it's conversational and not so like plucky and jokey, and mm-hmm. it just feels like people talking, they're swearing a lot, and like, it's like taking... Like, again, because we grew up loving Pulp Fiction and Clerks, and we were just like, if you can really gear that towards, like, comedy in, like, in a great way. And since no one would make Superbad, Judd, like, and me and him together thought that if we could make these, the guys who work in the store, kind of be almost like it was almost like a weird testing ground for, like, that type of conversational comedy. Whereas Carell's character was this like sweet kind of like island in the middle of the movie. We were mm-hmm. like, if we can make these guys, like, why don't we try this where we improvise and have it be very conversational and you guys can swear a lot and say all the sick shit you say to each other that makes each other laugh behind the scenes, but we never say it on camera because right. we're always like, that's too much or that's too crazy or people won't like that. But we were like, what if we do that on camera, you know? And that was really like the first time that any of us had done that. I think like they had done Anchorman where it was different though because the movie is tonally not real. So mm-hmm. like it's not – they improvised a lot, but it wasn't like actual conversations because it's like under this umbrella of like a false reality, you
right.
know? But this was the first time where it was literally like you can just say whatever you think you would say in this situation and there's no rating. Like – and we had never played in that environment before, and it was
dangerous.
Really the first time where we were all like, oh, we can really let it rip. And I remember I had improvised that thing about going to Tijuana and, like, seeing a woman fucking a horse, and it's like Carell comes into work, and he explains making an egg salad sandwich, and he's like, what'd you do this weekend? And I'm like, oh, I went to Tijuana. We went to see this woman fuck a horse. I'm like, it was not that cool. Like, it was kind of gross. And I remember, like, and it was, like, pretty. It was, like, on the scale of, like, the types of things people were saying in movies at that time on, like, the very far end of the spectrum.
Which is, and, which is why I asked you about the aristocrats thing.
Exactly.
Like, how often do you aristocrat it?
Yeah, and we were just making each other laugh. And I remember before the first screening, we were like, if that works, then we're fine. Like, then all these instincts we have of like what people want might be right. And I remember that moment was like a life-changing moment in many ways, like sitting in the theater when that part came on for the first time and seeing the audience just like explode in laughter.
Right.
And like you could see it was just like shocking to them, but also funny and also felt kind of real. And I remember so many people come up to me after the movie came out and be like, you remind me so much of a guy I used to work with, or you remind me so much of this weirdo who was in the back room at this place I would go to. And like, and you could see that we were kind of like tapping into this like relatable form of comedy that people, you know, at that time it was like Dumb and Dumber, which I love. Yeah. Like, it's one of my favorite movies ever, but it is not relatable, naturalistic, conversational comedy. You know, it's huge, crazy gags and very specifically like written and staged bits.
Right.
You know?
And very smart. Can I just give you credit too for putting an actor in there, a lesser known named Kevin Hart?
Oh yeah,
one.
Kevin Hart was in for
and
a year
then
old version.
The dude, Jerry, I want to say his name right, Jerry Bednar.
Jerry Bednar, he's funny too.
The East Indian guy who's just stopped
everything. Yeah. Is he okay?
He is okay.
Wait, what happened?
The other guy, not okay.
Okay. Wait, I was like, I didn't know.
Jerry's fine.
Jerry's the one that was working in the store that was like kept saying nasty shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
What's funny about him?
I got him mixed up with
the other guy.
The other guy who might still be in jail.
I think he is in jail. Yes.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Making sure.
No, Murder, Jerry's great. Yeah. Kevin Hart was great. Attempted.
Oh, attempted. He didn't succeed.
No.
Damn. It's a shame that happened. Because murder is bad, and I do not like murder.
You know the conversation's gone south when you have to explain that your feeling is murder is bad. Let me just clarify. Murder's bad.
So, okay.
Succeed. He what didn't I, succeed.
What I want to ask is, when you got the pitch, for 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. When you got the pitch for Knocked Up.
Yes.
How was it pitched to you so that you wouldn't take it personally?
Yeah.
Because the thing is, because the underhand tone of what Knocked Up really is we're going to pair this hot girl with, like, you.
I told it's something, it's and, a joke I was... It's
but
a,
I appreciate yes. you because you...
I was in on the joke.
Right, that's the thing. How do you not take it personal?
I think... And what I was actually thinking, of, like, one of the first other pieces of advice a stand-up comic gave me when I was, like, 13 was, like, whatever he – what's funny is this stand-up comic looked exactly like Garth from Wayne's World. Like, he was, like, a super skinny dude with long blonde hair and glasses. And he was, like, whatever – he's, like, you have to let the audience know that you are self-aware or they'll be uncomfortable. And he's, like, so if there's something about you that reads very obviously, like, don't – ignore that thing. Like, let them know you are more aware of it than they could ever imagine. And he's like, my whole opening 5 minutes is about that I look like Garth. Like, I fucking get it. And so I was always aware that I came across as like a schlubby kind of stonery loser. And I wasn't in any way self-conscious about representing myself like that because I knew I was not that.
That's what I'm saying. You got super confidence to do that.
I was highly productive. I could date women that were well out of my league on a physical level. I had a job. I had a nice apartment. I had a nice car. Like I was like at that point like getting successful. You know, so it was not. It was funny to me. And I remember Judd, we kept pitching these like crazy movies, me and him. We were trying to make Pineapple Express. We're like, want to make a big action movie. And he was like, you first just have to make something that like establishes who you are in the most like normal, relatable type of setting. Mm-hmm. And he just said it conversationally one day. It was literally like if you got a girl pregnant on the first date or something, like that's the type of movie we should make. And it was one of those things where it was like, oh, we actually could. That's actually a really good idea. What would that be like? Like, and him and his wife had got pregnant very early on in their relationship, and I think had to make some quick decisions as to whether or not they were going to kind of stay together and give it a go. You know, what the dynamics of the relationship were going to be. You know what I mean? I think they weren't planning on having a kid at that time, from my understanding.
Right. Shout out to Leslie Mann. No, she's talked. The shit.
Yes, exactly. Leslie's great.
She's the shit.
Very funny. And yeah. and so it was personal to me because, and I think the way that we were able to represent my living situation especially was highly personal to me, and all the roommates and all those guys were actually my friends, and I actually had lived with almost all of them at one point or another. And so like it did seem like a really, I was totally happy with it and thought I would be funny with it, you know? And there was a thing where I remember being like, oh, I can just make this guy like worse and worse and worse and like just dumber and dumber and dumber. And it's almost like the more inappropriate, like the worst thing I could say on a date almost is like the funnier the whole movie becomes. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Did you and Katherine Heigl ever circle back and become besties?
No, we've run into each other, though.
No.
But, yeah.
You know, I
have no, yeah, I wish her the best.
We'll skip that.
Okay. I'm waiting for this at the end. That's all.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, okay. Well, yeah, I guess I'll ask. Okay.
You don't have to.
No, it's not that. I'm just saying that. Is there ever a fear? Okay, I go to 30 Rock University.
Yeah.
So, and all that entails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm in the eye of the storm of. Yeah,
30 Rock really is.
It's a university. It's SNL. It's a big, giant campus.
It's the cathedral to which entertainment is built.
So, when you're, how hard is it, in your opinion, how hard is it for women to get a seat at the table?
Insanely hard. Way harder.
And in light of what's happening now and how comedy sort of has to re-examine itself and what was cool in 2006 might get a raised eyebrow now.
Yeah.
How has that...
I think what's cool in 2018 adjusted. Would get a raised eyebrow now.
Right.
So
how does that affect... Not how does it affect your world, but how does it affect the creative process, the fraternity process?
Yeah, where's the woman in the team?
We have women on our team.
That we can see.
I know you do. Yeah. But are you more, or is it the climate right now in Hollywood? Are they super aware of it now?
They say they are, but I don't think a lot has changed. And if you look at the movies that come out, almost all of them are made by white dudes. Like,
same.
You know, like it's very, like, not that. The actual, like, decision to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in a new social direction has not happened, I don't think. I think people are talking about it, and it's like a topic of conversation that's like fun for people to say, and I think they're like inching towards that. But have I seen like, oh, all of a sudden, if you look at the slate of every major studio and they're all more equally distributed between men and women? No, that's not the case at all.
I'm only asking,
women usually means white women, but that's the whole other thing.
No, 100%. And I think that but I think for us, I think we're lucky with comedy for us because we never... like peddled in that. I don't like we never peddled in something that I would have considered to be like, you know, I think our comedy, like I'm never complaining that like about like people being PC or like we can't say the stuff that we want to be able to say. Like to me that is like not an issue. And like you're either the type of person that like you want your work reflects who you are, no matter what. And so if you have your sensibilities trying to be in the right place at any given moment, then your work will reflect that. And I've found myself not really having to defend that much of what I've done in the moment that it has come out.
Okay.
I acknowledge that, again, a week later you look back and you're like, whoa, that's aged poorly sometimes, you know? like, yeah, I think there's jokes in Sausage Party that like 24 hours after it came out were inappropriate. Maybe 24 hours movie. Before it came out. But I think that, you know, we try not to be offensive. We try not to exclude people in our work. We try to be inclusive as possible. And we ourselves are those types of people. So it isn't this like chore to weave that into our work. And so,
well, I just know that people now are hyper aware that that has to happen or that has to be a thing. Whereas, you know, before you don't think like, okay, am I being inclusive? Am I offending this group or that group?
I think it's something that comedy is just. I think it's something we've trying to be aware of for the last few years. And I think Neighbors is the first movie that we really made, really trying to go into it, acknowledging that traditionally, especially that type of relationship that me and Rose, like a husband-wife relationship in a movie, is like always done a certain way, and we had to not do that. And like, it's always based on the fact that they hate each other and that they're not happy and that there's all this conflict in their relationship and that she's fucking lame most of the time and that like he's like the carefree fun one and she's like the uptight,
the nagging
one. And like, so that was, I think, and it was before all this, you know, all the current, you know, kind of revelations that are happening. But even then we were like, just how do we not do this in a lame way, you know? And how do we, and also like, we want the actors in the movie to be proud and happy with their work. And I think as someone who is both an actor and a writer and a director and a producer, like I understand what all those jobs entail. And I understand what it takes to make all the people doing those jobs feel like they're really doing something that they can be proud of and happy with. And that's something that was just started to become very important when I started to realize like, oh, like if we cast Rose Byrne in this role, we have to make it good and funny.
Right.
And we have to make her excited to come into work every day. And we have to make it that when she leaves work at the end of the day, she really felt like she was as funny as anyone else and given the opportunity to be as funny as anyone else.
So wait,
not like she was told like, you tell us to shut up as we say funny shit over here, you know what I mean?
How does that work? Okay, so how does that work? Like, break it down like we're in third grade.
Yeah.
All right, so if you're heading a project.
Yeah.
And you have to write for a specific character that you might not really put a lot of effort or you know, like what's their background. And first of all, when you write for a character or write for a movie, does each character have to have their own bio in your mind? Like,
to some degree, I think like
backstory.
Yeah, I think to some degree. I think it depends on how. In like, what's funny is like in This Is the End, like none of us really have any backstory. Like,
right.
We're kind of just who you assume we are,
yeah.
And you slowly and the emotional conflicts are very of the moment. It's based on, you know,
the world
you're seeing it play out in real time,
right.
Basically. So, but in general, yes, like some sense of backstory is helpful, and the more you can think of, the more it's probably good. But for I think for something like Neighbors, the conversations were literally like, how do we create a plot and a flow of events where that isn't contingent on these two characters having conflict with one another and instead is contingent on these two characters really being on the same team as one another? And right away, that allowed both characters to be outrageous and silly and stupid, and neither one was trying to control the other. If anything, they were always like encouraging the other to do stupider and stupider shit, kind of.
Right.
And so it's more understanding the dynamics going in and what the result that will produce. So it's like, if we go into the movie with this type of dynamic, the result will be this. And if we go into it with this type of dynamic, the result will be this. And so that's something we were aware of, is like, if we want the result to be this, the dynamic has to be very specific going into it, you know? And that's what we tried to do.
Yeah. So kind of a three-part question.
Yeah.
All right. Now in your career, what is your preference? Would you rather lean towards directing a project or writing a project to give to someone else to direct? Or what I would just say, blind job.
Yeah.
As in doing a project that you neither had no directing or no hand in writing it?
I do that less and less. Like, I don't act in a lot of other people's movies. So I don't get rather... I don't get asked to act in a lot of other people's movies, but it happens from time to time.
Oh, you gotta create your vehicles.
Yeah, the Lion King. That's
yes,
not
exactly.
True.
But so it happens, and I do it sometimes. I think what I really enjoy is writing something with the hopes that I will direct it and act in it, which has happened.
You want to wear all three hats?
Yeah.
Isn't that a nightmare?
No, it's almost, and a weird thing we've also found is in some ways, the more control we have over something and the more jobs we are filling, the less stressful it ultimately is, because most of our stress comes from fear that other people are going to fuck our shit up. Like, and so as long as we are controlling it, I'm not that worried. I'm more worried, is the director going to ruin this thing?
You so know that leads mean? To this leads to
Green
what have you learned? What have you learned?
Yeah.
About actually, I want to do two. What have you learned about Green Hornet and The Simpsons? Which I think for a comedy writer is sort of like this honor of wow. I'm doing this. I'm
writing
controlling a Simpsons episode.
Yeah.
So what lessons have you learned in those two instances that you would have changed? Now or made you wiser?
Yeah, I mean, Green Hornet was,
and I'm not a comic head.
No,
so.
Yeah, it's not really like. I think a few things when I look back at that. One is I really overestimated like our control at that point in our careers. Like I think that at that point we had kind of always been able to do whatever we wanted, you know, and I didn't predict how much a bigger budget, like, but all the movies we'd made at that point were like $20-30 million, and Green Hornet was like $120 million, and I didn't quite predict what that $100 million would do to the process, and how before we literally wouldn't talk to the studio ever, all of a sudden we were having meetings where we go through like every page of the script basically, and how like destructive that was to the process. And how
more money, more problems.
Yeah, and like the biggest thing was like we had an idea going into it that was slowly like completely, you know, deconstructed and built into something else. And it's one of those things that happened so slowly that like
– So they took your product
and
then said, well, we need to change this to make this that.
Exactly. What if we did this? Oh, we need a big actor for this role. And what about this? And we need this. And like
– But then with Gondry directing
– Yeah.
Whom I thought –
would be good. I think what he – and I've seen him since then. Like I think what he didn't predict also was – the scope of it and how, and that's what, because I think with artists, and you probably can relate to this, like, I think the more you do your craft or whatever, the more you realize it's not only what you are doing, but it is how you are doing it. Like, if you're a painter, you not only want to choose what to paint, you want to choose what paint you use, and you want to make your own canvas, maybe, and you want to choose where you paint it, and all this stuff, you know what I mean? But with film, it's sometimes that gets wrestled away from you, where it's like, here's the shot I want, and here's how I think we should do it. And they'll be like, nope, too expensive. Here's how you're going to do it. And that ruins the process, especially when you have a director like Gondry. And what I realize, I think what he realizes, is like his whole magic is not only in what he's doing, it's how he's doing it.
Right.
It's the materials used, literally. And that did not always apply to this scope of filmmaking, basically. And it was just like an inorganic combination of elements. And then there was a point, I think, where you're just kind of like, this seems like it's going poorly. I slept terribly throughout
so
the whole thing.
You felt even... Yeah, during the process, like, this might not turn out good.
For sure. There was, like, because it was rocky for, like, the year leading up to it, and there was a point, and this was also something I would probably do differently now. Like, we had just spent years working on it, and there's a moment where you're like, do we stop or just keep going? Because, like, after years, it felt weird to just stop, and it was just like, I think we just have to see this through, like, and that is something that I probably wouldn't do now, honestly. I think after that experience, I would just be like, let's just pull the plug, and maybe we all wasted 3 years, but maybe we all learned a lot in that 3 years and have some good experiences. But I think, like, that's something at the time that I wasn't prepared to do, which was just say, like, you know what, like, let's not fucking do this, you know?
So my parallel question to you is, okay. Now, as a person that's been doing what I've been doing, at least what I'm known for, 25 plus years, you know, we kind of had this discussion, like, are we sabotaging ourselves by not, like, wanting to go to bigger houses?
Yeah.
Like, we're now in the place where it's like, hey, you guys do know that we could book a night at blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
If you guys had the album in time, whatever. And my immediate thing was fear. Like, no, yeah. I don't want to play, you know, 17,000, da, da, da. Because I feel like my zone has always been in smaller theaters.
Yeah.
So for you, is a nine-figure budget sort of like a Dragnet horns? Dun, 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 like,
it's like...
Like, would you attempt to really go big, or do you feel that, you know, when you do lower budget stuff, then...
I think now, in order... We're writing a movie now that would be expensive. Like a pretty expensive movie. Not quite Green Hornet.
But I mean
expensive.
Like a popcorn film? Like
yes,
a,
but like a...
Summer of 2021.
Yeah, but like, but we're really trying to make it have all the stuff that we like out of movies, but we're trying to make, like, it's a more, it's a still like an R-rated, like, action comedy, basically, but we're... The types of movies that are in theaters have changed, and I think that's something that we're also aware of, is we like a lot of what are, it's interesting, like, we work backwards to some degree from, like, audience reaction. And we go to movies, and we sit in theaters, and you know what makes people cheer, and what makes people laugh, and what makes people shocked, and what makes people scared. And that changes over the course of years, you know? Like, the things... You know, there's some movies that have come out that 10 years ago got a certain reaction in theaters, and that same thing would not seem very exciting by today's standards,
yeah.
or that shocking by today's standards. And so we are trying to evolve. We instinctually must evolve with the climate, and we like making movies for theaters, and we creatively think backwards a lot from what would make a theater full of people have, like, this experience. Like, what would make a theater full of people be... on edge, and then excited, and then laughing, and then sad, and in or but the theater part is the tricky part, because a lot of movies like Superbad today, for example, probably wouldn't be in theaters. It'd be hard to get it in theaters. You know what I mean? Knocked Up even would more likely be a Netflix movie
really?
Today. It's just people talking in rooms. Like, there's no, you know, there's no big action in it. There's no, like, it's literally people sitting and talking for 2 hours. You know, like, we go to Cirque
well,
du Soleil.
I think organically it wouldn't happen, but, I mean, you got to admit that you're coming from the canon of the Apatow Mafia.
Yeah.
So even by 6 degrees of separation, like, you know, you personally would have to
It'd
release,
be a harder
like,
sell.
You would, I would think you would have to release 8 bona fide below 10 Rotten Tomato flops in a row before I'm like, nah, I ain't seeing Seth Rogen. You know,
well, not all our movies do well. I mean, like,
but even then, I'm aware of it. Like,
no, it's
there's
true.
Still,
yeah,
there's still some thing where it's like, oh, you're in it.
It's
this
out there.
Might be an event.
It might be good. Yeah, you know, it's out there, but it's still like, it's harder to get movies in theaters, and it's harder to compete for the cultural attention like that. And that to us is very important. Also, is we like it when we've seen that in the past we've made movies that like work their way into culture, and they're referenced in rap songs and in mm-hmm. other movies and on TV shows, and we like that. Like and that's not always a one-to-one thing with like success. It's just. You know, it's something that only happens, though, really with movies that are in theaters. Like, movies on Netflix are just streaming movies. It's much harder for them to capture a piece of the culture. And a movie like mid-90s, which was seen probably by one iota the amount of people that sees the average Netflix movie, captured the cultural attention mm-hmm. in a way that very few Netflix movies do, because it was in theaters. And when people saw it, they turned their phone off for 2 hours, and they sat in a dark room, and they actually watched it.
Yeah.
And you don't do that with Netflix movies. And I think that is going to become, when I look at why I want movies in theaters, that is it. Like,
but that's not all the way true, though, Steph. I was going to tell you, like, some certain movies command you to turn off the lights, watch like when The Irishman was one of those this season, Dolomite was one of those seasons. It just depends,
but
I think.
I think for some people, they choose to watch
but not
it that
everyone's going to have De Niro, Pacino.
No, no. It's the same thing with Dolomite.
And
there are certain events like Stranger Things.
And there's a million people watching The Irishman like as they're on Twitter, you know
that's
what I mean?
True.
And if it's
that's
in the theater, you don't even have that option. Like
right.
you have to watch it. And I think
I saw it in the theater.
Me too.
I didn't want to watch it.
Me too.
On Netflix.
Yeah, and I loved
yeah, I kept
it. And I think when you put a movie in the theater, you're telling culturally you are saying, like, this is worth you putting your phone in your pocket for 2 hours.
Right.
Like, and you're asking people to do that. And it is a big ask. And I think that, to that end, that's why we're writing a very expensive, big, fun action
Marvel
movie.
Because Marvel movies demand that from you.
Because we understand what we're asking is not a light ask. We're asking you to give up your addiction for 2 hours. and in order to do that, we have to repay you with something that is worthy of that.
So can
you
ask an Apatow Mafia question then? For that reason, I'm going to go back to something that I wanted to ask you guys when y'all were having the back and forth. Yeah. Do y'all ever consider, because as a woman of color, being a fan of what you guys do, I love it. Wouldn't change it, blah, blah, blah. However, time to change it, and not for nothing. I would be curious to see how a woman of color would be written into some of these situations, right? Because when you look at the majority of the movies that you guys do, like you said, I know you introduced the Rose Byrne situation, but not really. So have y'all started considering maybe?
Yes.
Maybe the next thing, maybe I don't know yet, but you're working on something.
Yes, very much. I mean, it is a prevalent topic of conversation.
But not on purpose. I don't want y'all to do it just because, oh my God, everybody's demanding that we have a woman and then we have to have a woman of color. But just because you see that, hey, wait a minute, that would be funny to get that perspective in this storyline.
No, 100%. And like, yeah, I mean, it's something that, yeah, I mean, the more perspectives and the more different people you have working on your material, the better it all is. Yeah, I mean, we produce the show Black Monday with Don Cheadle and Regina.
Oh, yeah,
Hall,
love
and,
that show.
Yeah, and,
got rid of my Showtime, but damn.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great. And
The Preacher.
Yeah,
so,
and we've just seen, and it is, and Preacher, exactly. And we've seen it's very rewarding and people get great. You know, the more representation, the better. I would never argue otherwise.
But I want to see you. Like, I love the Don Cheadle and the Regina Hall, but I was like, man, I want to see.
That'd be great. Yeah. I'm in.
Okay, so in hindsight, I was paying attention to it, but I don't recall. I remember the email fallouts with Sony. But
yeah.
The interview.
With the interview.
Yeah.
Was it worth it?
Yeah. Because it was crazy. And like.
And was there much damage?
And it was worth it because nothing.
Was there real damage?
No.
Yeah, what didn't we see?
Not to us. Like, other people, I mean, talk about sexism. Like, the only real person to be horribly damaged by it was Amy Pascal.
Yeah.
Her boss, Michael Linton, he wasn't damaged. But she was terribly damaged.
Wait, just correct me if I'm wrong. The fallout with the interview was, if you guys release this, we'll hack into your emails, and then
Kim Jong-un was
coming. They had already hacked into Sony, and they eventually threatened to like bomb movie theaters that played the movie, basically. Yeah. And that's why they pulled.
Was that okay? So it was released streaming, right?
Yes,
or was it
Google Play?
I've seen it.
Released it.
I just forgot where I saw it.
Google released it, and then Netflix released it. All within Google released it actually the day it was supposed to come out in theaters, and then Netflix released it 2 weeks later.
Ah, okay. And again, was it
worth it? it was. I mean,
publicity,
yeah.
Right?
It was like
all that publicity. Was
it was a really interesting exercise. Like I don't. the result of which is still fascinating, and I don't even. When you say is it worth it, I'm not even sure anyone knows what the fuck actually happened. Like, there was a big article in the Hollywood Reporter the other day that was like, "What really happened in the Sony hack?" And you read the article, and you're just like, "There's no answers here. What happened? I don't know what happened. People don't. They're not sure North Korea did it. They don't like. No people. Some
That's
people
what
think
I'm saying.
They did.
Some
people think they didn't. And so like, it's hard to retrospectively gain a lot of insight from something where you honestly aren't even sure what the fuck happened. Like as a movie, honestly, to me the biggest bummer is that the movie got pretty shitty reviews, and that doesn't happen to us that often, and that bummed me out. Like honestly, it was like for us like pretty bad. And so that to me was the thing that if I look back and could change something, I'd be like, oh, I wish the second act had like a better set piece in it. And I wish like we rounded out the third act more emotionally. But because that was the stuff that was in my control. You know what I mean? Like the actual product, the film was the thing we were in control of. And what I don't love is that it just wasn't received as well as our other movies.
It's just hit me. And I know we're going to wind up pretty soon, but, it just hit me that you're one of the cameos in one of Yauch's last pieces.
Yes.
Make some noise. I'm about to call it Fight for Your Right, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Make Some Noise was the name of the song.
That was the video. There was an extended version that was called Fight for Your Right Revisited.
So how was that pitched or come together or just...
Oh, man.
Were you guys aware at the time what his condition was and this was sort of like their swan song? Or?
We kind of got that sense as we were shooting it. Like, I knew he had been sick, but there was kind of like the public word on the street was that he was getting better, you know?
Right.
And then he just called me one day. I got a call from Adam Young.
Oh, cold call.
Yeah. And it was just like, oh, the greatest fucking phone call you could ever get. I was a huge Beastie Boys fan my whole life. Like, I'd met him once or twice before at like South by Southwest, I think. And yeah, and he was just like, we're making a music video and I want you to be Mike D. that was fucking great. And then we shot that video for 3 days, which is crazy for a music video. And every famous person ever was in. I think it was like halfway through day two where I was like, oh, this is like a kind of like a big last hurrah.
A swan song, yeah.
And then it got kind of sad and bittersweet, but was also fun. And like when I look back and think of was like, he was just telling, like, it was literally like we were all his, like, G.I. Joe toys and he was just playing with us. And it was like, for your birthday, here's all your favorite comedians and they'll do whatever the fuck you tell them to do for 3 days straight on this New York City backlot. And, like, that's literally, like, he would just be laughing, be like, Danny, kick the store in. Seth, throw the spear at him. You guys, dance on the cop car. And, like, and he would just be, like, laughing his ass off as we were just like, what? Like, there was no questions. Never like, why would I do that? It was just like, sure, yeah, whatever. Whatever the fuck you want, we're in. And, like, and it started to kind of imitate the video itself because we were there all the time, me and Danny and Elijah, who were the Beastie Boys, and then other cameos would come in for like a couple hours, and we were like in this mindset. It was like crazy. We were just like so geared to just do whatever we were told to do at any, like if they were just like body slam Laura Dern, I would be like, all right. there was like no, like I was just like in this like state of like, I'll just do whatever the fuck this guy tells me. That's what we're here for. And you could see people would come in and be like, this is crazy, like what are you guys doing in here, this is like you've gone nuts. And that really, like, we were just spraying fake beer on everyone's faces and like throwing, like it was a madhouse.
Danny McBride must be like, he writes too, correct?
Yeah, he writes Eastbound and Down and The Righteous Gemstones,
right? So
yeah,
he's one of my favorites.
He must be like awesome to work in my mind. Yes. Everybody who was in This Is the End in a way they do their own writing, but who it's like awesome to write with that blows your mind and you just like, the fuck you come up with that shit?
They're all great in their own ways. Like, yeah, like Danny. Jonah is truly the one, like, on set is, like, it's pretty remarkable to watch. Like, he gets, like, very locked in and is, like, it's, like, a pretty miraculous thing from time to time. Danny is very loose and biting, and like he's the comedian that kind of the other comedians are a little afraid to improvise with
because like, he hurts.
Yeah, because
so he is who he is in that movie.
But he's very sweet and nice. But it was like
I saw him once and opted not to say what's up to him because I just felt like he don't know me.
He's very sweet. He's such a nice dude, and like. Not and what it is one of those funny things where like he created those characters as a way to make fun of the guys he didn't like growing up, basically.
Oh.
And now that is who he is synonymous with, and his biggest fan base is probably
those exact people.
Yeah. Which is a bummer.
Wait,
for
speaking
him.
Of videos, how did Kanye contact you to do Bound?
You did it on your own? We just did it on our own. Yeah. And then he
Wait,
did.
Really?
Yes. And then he did ask
so
us.
So he just released it?
It was a Saturday
Night Live skit,
right?
He did it. No, we just did it. He released his video, and literally within an hour of seeing it, I was like, we're recreating this. and we had ours up like 24 hours later. Like it was so
fast. You know what it was?
Fast.
I'd never seen Kanye's version.
Oh, that's funny. You just saw ours.
Fun fact. I never seen a Kanye West video.
Yo! Ooh.
Wait, time out.
It's okay. I never seen Found all the way through.
I saw.
Don't say that.
Wait. Wow.
That's so much worse.
Wait a minute. I didn't mean it. It was a joke.
You wait, what's that Pacino film? Okay, I'm reading all that. What's that film? Not Donnie, Brasco.
Scarface.
Carlito's Way.
Carlito's Way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You remember the end of Carlito's Way when you think they're going to get away with it? It's like, hey, Benny? You go over here. No, you go over here. And then Benny Blanco from the Bronx.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
He stabbed you in the leg.
I'm so sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I've seen the College Dropout ones, but I haven't seen post that.
No, but he did ask us to come do it at his wedding.
Wow.
I'm sorry, what?
Me and Franco, yeah.
I don't understand.
He called us and was like, will you come do that at my wedding? And
did you do it?
Well, no, like, it was one of those things where, like, throughout the conversation, I like.
You thought he was trying to troll.
Willed him to realize how uncomfortable it would be, yeah. Which he slowly did.
He was Mr. Show,
yeah,
y'all.
Like, and I was just like, so we're just up there, and then yeah, he's just like, yeah. He's like, as I say this, I realize how fucking uncomfortable it would be. He's like, it would be funny for 10 seconds, but he's like, I'm asking you to fly to Versailles for like literally 10 seconds of shit. Like, he's like, ah, we shouldn't do it, but.
So, I mean, you lived a charmed sort of bucket listy life.
Yeah,
I want to know: did a project ever get away from you that you had your eyes on that you wish you?
That
did?
I wish we did.
Like you had a chance to,
no,
write or direct, blah blah blah. But
there are things like. No, I mean, yeah.
Did a Lin-Manuel come up to you? Yeah, I have this project called Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly.
Get away from me, kid.
No, there are things that, like, that came across our desk that then became very successful, but I don't think when I look like, oh, like, should we have really, like, spent, like, 2 years making, like, you know, like, Hobbs and Shaw or something like
no.
that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it would have been fun.
Wait, but, that was offered to you? Or?
Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was, like, outwardly offered, but there was a point where it's like, come in, you want to meet on Hobbs and Shaw? Or movies like Deadpool, maybe, years ago. Like,
yeah.
Very long time
I
ago.
I want to see you around.
But, like, I think that it's not... It just wasn't our thing, you know what I mean? Like, we weren't, like, the idea of, like, plugging in, I think that's what Green Hornet scared us off of more than anything, was, like, plugging into this, like...
Saying yes to everything?
Yeah, exactly. And plugging into, like, an IP that is, like, very...
already established.
Yeah, already established and having to, like, work within that. So, like, and working with, like, a big company is, like, just scary. Like, working with, like, a Marvel or, you know, like... And not to say we wouldn't do it. It's just scary, you know? And I think... And making, like, a friend... Yeah, like, making, like, a Hobbs and Shaw type movie where it's just, like, this movie's gonna get made no matter what. We're just the people, like, you know, serving you the dish.
Well,
you know?
The silver lining of Green Hornet is that you got your health in check.
Yes, I started together. Working out. I got, yeah, no, that was
And
great.
You maintained it.
I did so. Pretty well. Yeah, no, it was a lot of good... And we learned, like, so much. Like, that movie was made in a way movies aren't made anymore. Like... We built everything. It was practical effects. It was visual effects. There was huge stunt teams. There was, like, literally the stunt team that did Indiana Jones did the movie. Like, we got to learn from these, like, amazing people. And Gondry himself was someone who was amazing to learn from. And even though the result was debatable, like, I think very few experiences made us understand the production process and filmmaking in general more than that movie, because it was as logistically complicated a movie as exists in the world, and we had like a front row seat to every step of the process. So that was really interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Wish it made a better movie.
Hey, Seth, can I ask you a stoner question real quick?
Because
I remember famously listening to you on Stern one day, and he was asking you about working out while you were smoking, and you were like, yeah, I take a couple totes.
You could do that?
Yeah.
I've done it, and it's a little weird.
I smoke weed when I do everything.
So this is what I want to know. Right. So number one, I want you to give advice to young stoners, because I think you have to graduate to that level.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know when you got to the point where you knew that you could do everything stoned.
Yeah.
Because that's like next level.
It takes a while.
Yeah. Tell the babies. I try to tell them, like, don't go to school.
And by
after
babies,
school.
You mean me.
Yeah, exactly. Don't
yeah,
push it.
Like, I getting high is an event
new.
For me.
I
like,
think the thing most people... I'm always telling people to smoke a little bit of weed, like to take one hit of weed. That's what, like, I was just with David Chang on his Netflix show, and, like, we went around, smoked weed all day, and I just the whole time was like, one little tiny hit, and that'll get you going for, you'll be fine. And like, or set a timer. Take one hit and then see how you feel in 20 minutes.
Ooh,
and then maybe have another hit. But like, most people just smoke way too much weed and who don't smoke a lot of weed, and weed is super strong.
Yeah.
And one hit is enough, literally. Yeah.
Got any strain preferences?
I'm also a late sativa. Reactor.
Yeah, did you?
And why
Amir,
is that?
Do you
what is it?
Smoke sativa?
I prefer, was it hybrid?
Indica? Hybrid,
yeah. I'm like so new. I'm literally like 7 months into this.
Yeah.
So
we've been trying for 30 years.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I do it, it always hits me at the most inopportune moment. Like, I'll do it. All right, one time I did it at night.
Yeah.
And it felt a little weird, like, oh God, let me just sit down and relax. I fell asleep, right?
Yep.
That happens.
And woke up in the morning. It was like, oh damn, I didn't get high. That was a waste. And then And then 20 minutes into my day, right when I got on the drum set at Fallon,
you felt
all
high.
Of a, oh, whoa. Shit!
From the night before.
That's weird.
Yes.
Yeah, that is weird.
Like I have a five-hour. Well, see, I do edibles. I don't smoke.
So that's why.
See, that's
why.
Edibles. Yeah. Edibles are are a wild.
You don't do edible.
I do edibles very sparingly because they're wildly unpredictable like that. Like they're hard to it's hard to gauge.
Time them.
Yeah, you
and
know,
hard to get the dosage right too.
Yeah, it's hard to get the dosage right. It's hard to time them. Sometimes it depends on what. Sometimes they take an hour to kick in. Sometimes they take 2 hours to kick in. Depends on what you
takes
ate that
5 hours to kick in.
You need to take note of the stoners around you. Do you ever see Steve eating his weed?
If you eat your weed, there's none left to smoke.
Yeah.
Where's my
I'm sorry,
theme song.
Forgive me. Forgot.
I'll do it again.
My final question is, oftentimes, like right now, I'm watching The Morning Show, which is notably everyone. I knew them from the funny world,
money.
The comedy world, but yet they're doing drama. Like, would you consider? Because you did Steve Jobs, correct?
Uh huh.
The movie.
Yep. No, I did Steve Jobs.
What was that like? What was that experience
technical
like?
Would you want to further explore into the world of drama?
Yeah. I would.
And what role are you, what is your like, your fantasy thing that you haven't done yet that you really want to do?
We're writing that. I mean, that's what's nice about being able to write your own movies is, like, I've no one to blame but myself for if my career seems limited in scope as an actor. Like, yeah, I mean, what the thing we're working on now, I'm obsessed with, like, Buster Keaton and Jackie Chan. And so, like, I've always wanted to make, like, a highly physical, like, action movie, like, or action comedy. Like, something that is almost entirely predicated on action and not a lot of talking at all, and that has just always been something that I always enjoy shooting, that type of stuff, and so that's something that we want to do, and that's what we're working
like
on
Bean?
Right now.
Is that like some?
Yeah, kind of like a really violent Mr. Bean.
Oh boy. All right, well, you know, Seth, we really thank you. Damn, we didn't even get to your hip-hop.
It's okay.
Roots.
I'll come back.
We'll just assume that you like hip-hop.
I love it.
Anyway. No, we really want to thank you for coming
yes,
here. Ladies
thank
and gentlemen,
thank
give
you
it
for
up
having
Seth
me.
Thank
you for
right.
the preacher, too.
Thank you.
I love that
thank
show.
You. Yes, on behalf of Sugar Steve and Unpaid Bill and Boss Bill and Laia and Fonte. This is Questlove. You've been listening to Questlove Supreme. Thank you very much, Seth. We will see you on the next go-round. Peace, y'all.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
A little bit of weed.
Just a little.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.